Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the principal in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Garrett Gibson, a principal at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. Between the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the HUD budgets being discussed in the House and Senate, among other items, a lot of eyes have been on Washington. My partner Eric and I hosted a webinar at the end of July on the One Big Beautiful Bill's impact on the light tech industry, and today we're going to cover those impacts and implications. Before we dig into this, I have some news to share from around the industry. In July, the House Appropriations Committee marked up and approved by a vote of 35-28 its fiscal year 26 transportation, housing and urban development, and related agencies appropriations bill. The committee bill passed would provide $67.7 billion for the U.S. Department of HUD and urban development in fiscal year 26, which is a little less than a $1 billion, specifically $939 million, below the fiscal year 2025 enacted level. One item to note is the zero funding of the Home Investment Partnerships Program, reflecting the president's request to lower overall dollars and budgets. The justification for this was that there's still HOMARP left to be spent. Note that the Senate Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development and Related Agencies budget should be out soon, and so we'll report back on this. Obviously, the industry is hopeful and talking to the senators that that home fund allocation would remain the same or near the same at a little over $1 billion. In other news, a report that I know Garrick and I like to take a look at annually is the National Low-Income Housing Coalition's report entitled Out of Reach 2025, The High Cost of Housing. This report highlights the disparity between income and rent levels. The data shows that the average hourly income needed for a full-time worker to afford a two-bedroom unit in the United States is $33.63 per hour, which of course is a little bit more than four times the federal minimum wage of $7.25. You can download this report for free at nlihc.org, and they come out with other helpful reports various times throughout the year. One other item of interest that I'm going to note, and getting back to home funds, is the Housing and Insurance Subcommittee of the Housing Financial Service Committee, that's a mouthful, held a hearing recently to consider draft legislation proposed by Chairman Mike Flood to make significant reforms to the Home Investment Partnerships Program. The discussion draft includes items such as exempting home projects from Build America, Buy America, or BABA, raising the threshold at which Davis-Bacon prevailing wage requirements apply to home projects going from 12 units to 50 units, and substantially streamlining the environmental review process for many home projects. We're definitely going to keep our eyes on this, as that's obviously one big thing that we're going through a lot right now is the home requirements or the home funds requiring BABA domestic requirements, domestic sourcing requirements. So something very applicable to our industry. Now, Garrick, ready to turn over to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the implications on the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. We're going to kind of talk about what was part of it, but probably more importantly, how it's going to impact your pipeline, planning, financing structures, and so forth. The legislation includes some long-anticipated changes to bond-financed housing, as well as new timelines and technical updates that are already shaping the market. Again, the act was signed July 4th. We'll keep our focus on practical takeaways. The first item we're going to talk about between Garrick and I is the permanent 12% state allocation increase for 9% low-income housing tax credits. Garrick, would you kind of jump into this program and how it begins now in 2026?
Yeah, so this change could result in a nationwide increase of additional LIHTC units annually. It's basically based on historic credit usage and per unit allocations. So states with high demand and efficient QAPs like California, Texas, and New York likely are going to stand to see the greatest uptick in production capacity. So the way it works, so in 2005, for instance, the per capita 9% credit allocation was $3. So if this changes, say, to $3.05 in 2026 before the 12% increase, then you would add a 12% increase would be on that 305 would be around 340, right around there. So that would be the multiplier times the population. So therefore, we will have to see what the increases will be for 2026 in reality to get to this 12%. But the idea is that it's going to create a lot more credit capacity for 9% allocations. So hopefully that translates into more projects.
Absolutely, Garrett. And it's a durable supply side boost to the housing credit system and gives state agencies more room to address backlog and, of course, preservation needs. Just looking at the numbers at a few states, you mentioned California earlier, Garrick. They currently have approximately $116 million of 9% allocation in 25. Just increasing that by 12% is almost $14 million of new allocation. That's $14 million, maybe a couple million dollars. That could be six, seven, eight deals, something of that nature. In a smaller state, a little bit smaller state like Wisconsin, they're a state I reside in, had about $17.7 million of 9% credits in 25. So a 12% increase would be $2.1 million increase. Again, probably a couple deals, but two deals, six deals, seven deals, you go around the country, maybe that's 100, 150 more deals per year of 9%. And then, Gary, on that point, now there's 100, 150 more deals of 9% credits out on the market. So maybe just briefly, we'll talk about what Garrick and I hypothesize, and we get this question a lot already, is tax credit pricing. And again, no one's got the crystal ball. And Garrick, I know we're going to talk about bonus depreciation a little bit, and there's things seem to be pulling at pricing on both sides. Back to supply and demand, well, we're going to have a lot more credits on the market between the 9% credits we just talked about and hopefully a lot more 4% deals, which Garrick, we're going to talk about in a minute. So supply is way up. However, a lot of energy credits are being scaled back or phased out under the act, and we know there was tax credit equity that was chasing those credits might come back to LIHTC. We're going to talk about 45L a little bit and energy credits and then bonus depreciation. So it's kind of like this pull on both ends. So I know, Garrick, we're seeing some saying, hey, we think pricing could stay the same. We're seeing it could drop a little bit. Just maybe a couple notes from you, Garrick, on that point.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, nobody has a crystal ball of where it will go. But like you said, there's going to be some pressure on other energy credits. I would suspect some of the folks that were investing in those markets could go to maybe back to historic tax credit transactions and possibly come back into more LIHTC investments. So I suspect it could possibly make the pricing slightly go down, maybe because of the more stock that's on there. But we'll see.
Perfect. Very good. Now switching gears to really it should be more impactful. Many are projecting to be actually much more impactful to the industry overall than just the 12%, 9% increase is the reduction of the 50% test to 25% of aggregate basis. And really the industry has been asking for this really since the fix of the 4% credit as more bond deals are getting done and so forth. Starting in 2026, only 25% of the aggregate basis of a project must be financed with tax and bonds to qualify for 4% tax credits. This, again, is going to be a game changer. We're hoping it's a game changer, particularly in states that are oversubscribed for their private activity bond volume. And various reports, that's been around 50% of the states over the last 2, 3, 4 years. So we, again, hope to see a lot more volume. Garrick, would you mind just maybe a few more technical notes in that comment?
Yeah, here's a few, like, technical notes on like 25% test details and some planning considerations, right? So the bonds must be newly issued in 2026 or later. Bonds issued in 2025 but funded later won't qualify. However, you could sort of get a supplemental bond issued in 2026 allocated to eligible costs. So that can help qualify a project under the 25% rule if you had an initial issuance in 2025. And so those supplemental issues, you got to be careful to structuring them, right? Because they're generally capped at the lesser of what's needed to meet the old 50% test or 5% of aggregate basis. So these planning nuances matter, especially for projects that are closing in late 2025. So watch out for those scenarios where you have an issuance, but it hasn't quite got funded. And is there a way to sort of maneuver around that? And then obviously the desired effect, what's trying to happen is the rationale is it's supposed to unlock some more state bond volume cap with respect to more transactions, bring more 4% transactions to the market, whether or not that it's going to be another 50% more projects there remains to be seen because you still have to size those bonds up with a cushion. A lot of times people were using 55% when you're issuing the 50% bonds. Likely you'll see somewhere around 30% it would make sense to me to do it at some formula of that or what you can support in perm debt, so you don't have to have taxable slash tax exempt two different issuances on your perm side if you're not taking out the bonds, for instance. And there's some other secondary effects that we can discuss, but one of the things that you and I know we actually had discussed previously was whether or not it's still going to put some pressure on the transactions, because if you have less taxes and bonds, which are usually at the lower rates, it's likely that you're going to supplement that gap with taxable debt, taxable bonds, which we're seeing generally holding higher interest rates. So that could create a little more carrying cost. But all of this stuff really plays into the types of bonds. There's drawdown bonds. There's bonds that are funded up front and that you can invest. And whether or not this 30% or the 25% test, where you're getting 30% of your aggregate base, is probably typically an allocation of what that really does to your capital stack in terms of adding some sort of secondary effects that nobody was really thinking about, which now they are.
Right. And Garrick and I have been talking to a number of state housing agencies, to Garrick's point, what are going to be the best practices. And to Garrick's point exactly, perhaps it's the lesser of 30% on this test and analysis, or the amount of permanent debt. Because again, to Garrick's point, A, we want cushion. That's the 30% versus 25. And or B, let's size it to the perm debt, so we don't have the, to Garrick's point exactly, this differential, the complications, the differential in rates between tax exempt and taxable. So our permanent debt can hopefully just be all tax exempt as well. So we'll see how states play out. I think that's the topic Garrick will stay on for the remainder of this year and into 26, as this is again effective for those deals and issuances and so forth. So, but very exciting. Various projections show maybe a million more units generated over the next 10 years because of the tax exempt bonds, this test going from 50% to 25%.
Yeah, and Don, it's also probably worth noting too, right? If you need a supplement with which normally we're thinking taxable to make that gap up, there's always recycled taxes and bonds that you can kind of plug in when permitted, where it's permitted. That could help offset some of that pressure and restore more favorable leverage to counteract the rate differential.
Perfect. Now, Garrick and I are going to touch on just a few other additional legislative changes that impact our light take industry that came out of this act as well. Again, beyond the core LIHTC changes, the act also makes permanent 100% bonus depreciation for property with a recovery period, of course, with 20 years or less. And for these assets that are placed in service after January 19th, 2025, if not subject to a binding written contract entered into before January 19th, 2025. So I know, again, that's a mouthful, but a great opportunity for investors and helping with yield as you kind of have your projects. And maybe you're probably also familiar with cost segregation studies, where you're looking at the useful lives of property and seeing what can truly be classified as 5- and 15-year property and being able to bring that into a bonus. Garrick, any kind of thoughts on this provision?
On bonus depreciation, it seems like everybody's welcoming bonus depreciation. As you know, obviously it's been tearing down and seen a lot of cost segregation activities because of that. But now with 100% bonus here, it's likely that, I don't know if cost segregation activities will change just because you're still able to even maximize even more. But everyone I talked to in a couple of conferences I've already attended since this has come out is pretty excited about having this back. So I think it's going to be a key provision here.
Gary, there are a few things that unfortunately, maybe not the positive or kind of taken out or phased back. Do you want to kind of hit that?
Yeah, I know that the energy efficiency incentives, they're sort of phasing those out. And most of the time when I think of it, I think for a LIHTC project, I think it's a 45L, but you also have the 179 cap D expensing, you know, which is more on the commercial side, where the 45L, they had revamped it and with the IRA had new multiples of the whatever the base amount would be. So you can get up to 2,500 or 5,000, depending on you were zero energy ready or Energy Star. So now that credit obviously is phased out, as well as the 179D expensing. They're effectively eliminated for any projects that are putting units online, placing in service, or they call it acquired, right, after June 30th of 2026. And so obviously, if you're in process and have this going, right, this is a planning opportunity to figure out whether or not you either, if you haven't started putting those costs in order the credit that you were modeling to get, if because of this, you're not going to have it, it's probably pertinent that you either look at your budgets and try to reshuffle them or figure out if you're going to sort of meet the deadlines there.
Yeah, Garrick, that's something we're definitely going to watch because that question's come up, right? We're now less than a year from this June 30th, 2026, and construction takes 12, 18 months to complete on many projects. So I think people are wondering if there will be clarifications in other writings about the act to address situations like that, where that piece of the construction is not going to start till after 26. And obviously, it hasn't been a huge piece of the capital stack, but yet if it's $250,000, $500,000, we've seen a deal with $1 million. That's real money and creates real gap without it being there for projects that were designed as high performance, energy efficient buildings.
Correct. I mean, if you're not going to get that subsidy that you were hoping to help cover some of those costs because now it's not going to work, then you might either remove those costs. But if you don't, then you probably have some widened financial gaps to deal with.
Garrick, one other thing I know 163J also mentioned in the bill.
Oh, yes. That's right. So basically what they did is that you can now take depreciation and amortization and now add it back to the adjustable taxable income. Basically, this is allowing more room to deduct interest expense there because of that add back. For LIHTC and real estate partnerships, I guess this change can increase interest deductibility without electing out and having to use the 30-year ADS, which everybody's kind of already been in process on every single deal. It seems like we do. Everybody's opting out having they're using 30-year ADS versus the 27.5-year makers, so they're not limited on those deductions.
Perfect. And finally, I'm just going to address solar credits, which, again, I know in the last, again, with the Inflation Reduction Act, we see more developers looking at solar and so forth. But what the Big Beautiful Bill Act says is if construction does not begin by July 4th, 2026, or 1 year after it was enacted, the project must be placed in service by December 31st, 2027 to qualify for the Section 48 investment tax credits. If you miss both deadlines, then no credit applies. And again, that capital will not come into your project or that credit cannot be monetized.
Correct, right? Because this means many planned solar LIHTC hybrid type projects could lose that eligibility if those timelines aren't tightly managed. So especially particularly in jurisdictions where you have like long permitting cycles, slow utility type interconnection processes. So I would definitely watch, if you have this in your project, look at those timelines and when you have to meet those things and watch it very carefully.
Perfect. And then just one last thing we just want to mention are what was excluded. As you were probably following the bill, and especially on the housing side, you saw certain drafts that include this, certain drafts that didn't, but what did not make it was the proposed 30% basis boosts for both rural and tribal areas. We're in there for a split second, but removed in final negotiations, just really focusing on this 50% tax reduction, which is, again, significant, right? I think the industry overall is applauding the improvements and the just sheer number of additional units that should be generated from these provisions. But again, sad that this boost, we know tribal and rural projects, lower rents, costs are costs, expenses are expenses. It's just really hard to get those deals done. So these tools, the 9% increase, the 50% to 25% should definitely increase deal volume and more credits on the market.
Yes. One of the other things I was thinking about, Don, is the fact that we're looking at this legislation and we're, you know, it's the 25% from the 50 and then the increase in the LIHTC. But the fact that it's like permanent, 100% bonus, and obviously nothing's permanent, they can change the law later. But the fact that it's permanent is great because then it's not a temporary kind of thing. So which lends itself for people out there to say, hey, this is permanent. We'll spend the time to figure out if there are different types of financing structures that we can try to figure out here to sort of pair with the fact that this is going on. So I'm hoping the fact that these are permanent changes, that maybe we'll see some evolving financial structures that we always see come out whenever things change. So I'm looking forward to seeing what comes our way.
With that, it was kind of fun to talk with Garrick about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and its impact on the low-income housing tax credit industry. Please reach out to Garrick or myself with questions, especially around the opportunities with bonds and the 25% test. Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrick Gibson.
Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at build@BakerTilly.com. That's build@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzzhouse.